From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Edward Dolnick says there were plenty of geniuses around to figure out where babies come from. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, no one could. Isaac Newton? No idea. Galileo? No clue. Copernicus, Kepler, Aristotle, Da Vinci? No one could figure this out. I mean, they knew some of the basics. Men and women have sex, and sometimes the woman gets pregnant, but most everything else about the process was a mystery. In fact, it wasn't until the late 1800s that scientists finally figured it out. Dolnick has a book that explores the long, long journey to figure out where babies come from, and we're talking about it today. Some of the theories are just ridiculous. Join us after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I'm just going to warn you right up front. This show is about where babies come from. So just know that we're going to talk about sex and genitals and things. So it may not be the right show for the kiddos. But you know how this works, of course, human reproduction. A mother provides an egg. A father provides sperm. And each month, one of the woman's ovaries releases an egg, which makes its way through a fallopian tube. And if the couple has sex at the right time and one of the millions of sperm cells fuses with the egg, you get a baby. We know that. In fact, we take for granted that we know that. But the science writer Edward Dolnick says the fact is it took hundreds and hundreds of years to figure out where babies come from. Scientists, really brilliant scientists, could not work it out. Dolnick's new book is about the story of how they finally did. Along the way, there were all kinds of great characters and crazy theories and failed scenarios. Dolnick is joining us today. He's the former chief science writer for the Boston Globe. His book is called The Seeds of Life. Recently, he joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. So I guess I wanted to begin with, I wonder, were you, as you, before you started really digging into this, as you just first started looking at it, was it surprising that it took humankind so long to figure out where babies come from?
That was a big surprise to me. It's amazingly recent that they figured it out. It was in the late 1800s. Yeah. I never thought much about it, but my guess would have been thousands of years before that.
You say, 1875, and eventually we'll get there in this conversation, but you say it wasn't really until then that, in fact, this is how you put it. You said everything to do with conception and development was wrapped in darkness. Now, explain why that was, you think. There's a lot of complicated questions which we can get into, but basically, why was it wrapped in darkness?
Well, part of what goes on is that this is something that takes place, conception and development do, inside the body, mm-hmm. and you can't look. So the things that you want to get at are hidden away from you. Moreover, things like the microscope come late, and on top of that, there's taboos against anatomy. So even if you could look, you're told that you shouldn't. So altogether, this mystery that you'd love to know the answer to, you're not allowed to get at.
You say the story also, at least in terms of biology, doesn't have a straight line. This is not a group of scientists going toward this goal. And I wanted to ask you about this because later in the book, you explain that one of the problems was biologists in these early days didn't really have a scientific framework. Other scientists did, but biologists were just sort of trying different things, unlike other scientists who seem to have a more clear process. Is that right?
That is right. And it was another surprise to me. In the old days, this book is mostly about the 1600s, 1700s. Right. physics was considered hard the way we consider it hard today. Today it's all wrapped up in math and it has arcane vocabulary about black holes and infinite dimensions and things like that. And in the 1600s, physics also was seen as complicated. And it was taken for granted that biology would be much easier because physics dealt with astronomy and stars and comets and things you can't touch. And biology dealt with earthworms and bugs and birds. And so it should be easy. That was the assumption that everybody took into this. And then it turned out that the living world was complicated and a tangle and a snarl. And the physical world was much more tidy and orderly. And that took everyone by surprise.
Yeah. Immanuel Kant said, there will never be a Newton for a blade of grass.
Yeah, he said that about 50 years before Darwin came along. So there was the Newton of a blade of grass.
Part of the problem, it seems, was also philosophical or maybe even religious. You mentioned in the book that if people were going to figure this out, they were going to have to understand, of course, that a living organism has the capacity to, as you put it, assemble itself. But that was really just unthinkable for most of the history of the world.
Yes. But part of the fun of this book is that we watch great geniuses knocking their heads against a wall, against a riddle that today a 10-year-old could explain to them.
Right.
But the moral that we draw from that shouldn't be, oh, how foolish of these people. They actually were quite brilliant. Part of the reason they had such trouble is that what they were trying to understand actually is an astonishing mystery. And although today we know the answer and we can happily explain it, if you think about it, the notion that this tiny bit of tissue should assemble and grow and eventually become 6 or so pounds of howling, shrieking baby.
Right.
That's an astonishing thing. And for us to say, oh, how could they not know? Well, it's an amazing notion to have come up with.
Yeah. Even today, as you say, it's so far-fetched, it's hard to believe.
If you didn't know the answer,
yeah,
you would never buy it.
Yeah. But the idea, getting back to this idea that there was also a kind of philosophical problem they had to wrap their heads around, is you talk about how this was a time when science and religion was kind of wrapped, they were wrapped around one another. And so every discovery or every insight that you would propose had something to say about God, I guess.
Yeah, at this point, today we have talk about a clash between science and religion. But in the early days of science, there wasn't a clash because the scientists and the most devout people were the same people. It wasn't that religion told science, don't look here or go over there. Mm-hmm. Scientists thought that what they were doing in their scientific work was demonstrating the grandeur of God. They felt that their science was religious work. And what was amazing to them and bewildering to them is that when physicists tried to explain the inanimate world, everything was tidy and perfect. The planets went in perfect curves. A rock that fell according to a precise equation. And they expected that the same would happen to the living world because God had made the living world as well as the inanimate world. But when they looked at the living world, instead of things being tidy and clockwork, everything was a muddle and haphazard. And that was bewildering to them.
Yeah. It's interesting. There were these two big questions that were entangled, you say. Two big ones. Where do babies come from? That's one. But also, what is life exactly? Explain that, if you would.
Those two questions, which sound quite different to us, turned out to be all wrapped up in one. The scientists who started to ask the straightforward question, where do babies come from, thought that they were asking a question that had to do with anatomy and dissection and looking closely and scalpels and bits of the body, that they could answer it in that practical way. But they found that in trying to answer what bit does what, they inevitably found themselves taking on this much vaguer, murkier, harder question of, well, what makes one bit of stuff alive and one bit not? What's the difference between a dog standing on his hind paws or barking out the window and the windowsill that he's leaning his paws on? What's magic? What's special about living things? And so the straightforward question that they had started to answer about how are these babies constructed came to enter into this philosophical territory of what is life in the first place.
Mm. It seems like for a time, and for a long time, even though people were trying to figure this out, in some ways there was just a kind of concession that maybe we will never know, that God had worked all of this out and he's just for some reason kept it from us. And so they kind of conceded the point, or a lot of people did.
One notion was that this was just too hard a mystery for our limited human minds to probe. In the same way now, there's lots of scientists who talk about where ideas come from, what's the nature of consciousness, could you someday make a robot that was not merely able to move but able to think and feel? And there are other people who say that we're just not there. That's a question that sounds tempting, but it's one that we're not going to be able to answer. The answer is too deep for us.
Yeah. What got you interested in this particular question? Where did you start?
I started with scientists like Isaac Newton and Galileo, who had talked about the moon and about comets and things like that. They had taken what before they came along was considered impossible to pin down, and they had sorted it all out, and they had made this amazingly triumphant, clear picture of the universe. The universe worked like clockwork, and now with their heads puffed up from that triumph, they decided that having taken on the heavens, they'd move their attention down to Earth. They'd solve the next mystery. They talk about how living beings came to be, and they expected that would be easy, and everyone would have a parade and cheer for them as they announced their latest triumph. And so, what was fun is that their guess was so far wrong.
Yeah. So let's go back to, let's say, around the 1600s. What was the understanding? Was there much that we could agree on at the time, or was it all just a mystery?
Well, the brute facts of sex and conception were well known, in the sense that people knew that men and women have sex often, and sometimes they have babies. People understood that perfectly well. They knew about 9 months of pregnancy and that kind of thing. What they didn't have any idea of is how it worked. What is it that's going on? How does that bit of huffing and puffing months ago produce a new human being now? How could that be? And furthermore, they had no notion of does timing have anything to do with it, or how come sometimes there are twins? What's going on when twins are born? Or how come some couples are fertile and some couples aren't fertile? All that kind of thing is completely mysterious.
We'll get into the details as we go, but maybe mention a few of the ideas that are out there. Aristotle's is kind of interesting.
So people have been trying to solve this for a long time. What's going on that once upon a time there wasn't a baby in the world, and now there is? Where does it come from? There's something new that there didn't used to be. And Aristotle has this picture that a baby or an embryo is a kind of hodgepodge, an accumulation of semen on the one hand, that's the male's contribution, and menstrual blood on the other. Mm-hmm. So these raw materials are the basis that the embryo starts with and grows from. And the theory is that when women aren't pregnant, then you do see menstrual blood, and so now they are pregnant. All of a sudden, that disappears. But on the other hand, something does appear, this new embryo, and so he puts one and one together and comes up with, well, maybe not two, but some number, and proposes this theory.
Yeah, that man's semen was curdled by the woman's menstrual blood. That was also a concept he had in mind.
Yeah, there was a notion of, yes, curdling was a big image of even the Bible talks about babies. It's akin to some kind of milk-forming cheese model is what they have in mind.
There's one scientist you point out, and I think this was in the 1700s, who kind of added up all of the failed theories, came up to 262 groundless hypotheses about where babies came from.
Yeah, everybody had a guess. Yeah. One of the reasons was you couldn't test these, and so it was easy to come up with new theories. The fellow who proposed that had his own theory, which was in turn promptly shot down.
Right, right. But this is interesting, too, and this comes up time and time again in this story, and that is the role of women, or the lack of a role of women in the process. Because you say the most confusing of all for these male scientists, and they were all men in those days who were doing this, was the part of women in the process. And they had these, and you say, and it's a kind of general disdain. I mean, these scientists, you say, at that time, basically just took for granted that women were their physical and mental inferiors. And that had to have been an obstacle in figuring this out.
Well, it would have been an obstacle for nearly any project you took on.
Yeah.
But when the project was to figure out how it is that men and women together create babies, if you start from the assumption that one of the partners isn't up to much, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
And what these scientists, as you say, almost 100% male in these early days, what they couldn't figure out is what is it that the woman contributes here.
Yeah.
The male contribution was plain. They could see it.
Mm-hmm.
But for women, their strong, strong impulse was to say that what the woman does is grow, is provide a nurturing site for this male creation to grow from tiny tissue to full babyhood. That's her role. She's a kind of incubator.
It's interesting. Also, I'll mention how other cultures, China, India, other non-Western cultures, had made such important scientific breakthroughs. And you go through some of these in the book. But when it came to sex and conception, not so much.
Yeah, I was surprised at that, because often when you take the trouble to learn about other cultures, non-Western cultures, it's amazing how far they've gone in astronomy or in medicine. Time and again, although the names we know for some breakthrough are Western, it turns out that there's a name we don't know from China or from India who figured the same thing out centuries or even more than that before the West. But with the story of sex and conception, that's not the case. The question of exactly how does this happen, what's going on in conception and development, was a question that most cultures, most non-Western cultures, didn't bother with. They were satisfied with the brute fact of the 9 months and that kind of thing. And they tended to focus their attention on the much more practical question of how do we prevent pregnancy when we want to, or what would be the special foods or special positions or special conditions of moonlight or sunlight or whatever that would give babies, or boys rather than girls, or girls rather than boys, rarely. What would bring that about? That was the focus, that kind of practical matter.
And just while you're on that point, I should mention some of these were really interesting. In Egypt, there was a recipe for contraception which called for feces of crocodile smashed up with fermented dough. And there were a lot of these kinds of recipes, it looks like.
Yeah, there. To this day, there's a notion with lots of projects that the more involved and the more exotic the ingredients and the more difficult finding them is, the more likely this particular venture is to pay off. And so here was a terribly high stakes thing, conception, contraception. And so the recipes tend to be incredibly elaborate and gruesome, and lots of them involve choking down some vile ingredients, like you say, or maybe even some luxurious things like pearls, although their pearls probably aren't appetizing as a food. But the point was the rarer and more difficult the ingredients, the more likely this recipe was to be the real thing.
Here was my favorite of this section of the book. This was a recipe for an aphrodisiac. It also came from Egypt, apparently ancient Egypt. Take dandruff from the scalp of a dead man who was murdered, add the blood of a tick from a black dog, a drop of blood from the ring finger of your left hand, and your semen.
Yeah, it's a remarkable recipe, and you can see that on the times when it didn't work, the guru, the medical sage, could tell you, "Are you sure it was a black dog?"
Right.
Go back and try again.
Yeah. Edward Dolnick, his book is called The Seeds of Life. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the science writer Edward Dolnick. His new book takes us through the hundreds and hundreds of failed ideas and years before someone finally figured out where babies come from. The book is called The Seeds of Life, and as you can guess by the subject, it might not be the right show for everyone. Well, you write about how really the first great advance in understanding this mystery comes, I guess it was just before 1500, and it's Leonardo da Vinci, and others, I suppose, but we can focus on him. He starts really looking at anatomy. And this is a section, you know, you spend a good amount of time talking about anatomy or the way anatomy was thought about in those days. And we'll get to dissection here, too, but talk a little bit about the way people were thinking of the way a body worked before they actually spent much time looking into the bodies.
Well, there was a great question about if you were allowed even to look. Was this, if the body was God's cathedral, then to go yanking open those cathedral doors, maybe that was a bit of blasphemy. That was a common view. And for a long, long time, people were told, doctors were told, that you shouldn't look in the first place. God had set things up. The body worked in its wondrous ways. And to look inside was not, as we would take it, to be a virtue, to show that you had a deep devotion to knowledge and information. It was taken to be that you were a kind of peeping Tom, mm-hmm. that you insisted on looking where you had no business looking.
It's a taboo for the Greeks and the Romans, you say. But there were a couple of stories that I just wanted to take note of, and I'm sure they were legend, but there's one story about Cleopatra kind of ignoring the taboo and having some of her pregnant slave girls dissected, I guess.
Yes, that this was a story supposedly true, that at least believed in ancient times, mm-hmm. that this was, among other things, a measure of absolute power. Cleopatra got it in her head to wonder what development looked like, and she was able to carry out the experiment since she had human subjects ready at her disposal.
Yeah. Also kind of troubling legend about Nero that you include in the book.
Yeah, Nero, who was famously the most capricious and self-indulgent of all the Roman emperors, which is a remarkable accomplishment considering the company. First has his own mother murdered and then has her sliced open, so while he watches he wants to see, he says, the place where he was conceived. And so this is all by way of idle curiosity. Mm. And there are drawings supposedly from the time of Nero looking on with curiosity while his mother is on a stone slab in the surgeon's hands.
What got Leonardo da Vinci interested in dissection?
Well, Leonardo's interested in everything under the sun.
It's true.
And he has this notion of the body as a machine. He's terribly interested in mechanical engineering, how things work, the pipes and the levers and the pumps, and the body, he suspects, is going to be one more example. So he's not put off by this taboo, you mustn't look. He wants to look nearly everywhere, but he is put off by the physical difficulty of cutting up bodies. It's cold and it's dark and it's grimy, bloody work, and he's a squeamish fellow, and he has to work up his nerve to do it.
I was interested in his sense of sexual anatomy, because you say his sexual studies, for the time anyway, kind of broke ground. There's this cutaway drawing that you refer to in the book of this man and woman having sex, at least his theory of how it worked. He got it completely wrong, I guess.
he was terribly curious, as who wouldn't be, but you couldn't look directly at how sex works. There's certainly nothing akin to an MRI scan in his day. Yeah. So how are you going to look? And in fact, he's well before the microscope as well. So even if you were willing to look, it's hard to find what you're looking for. But Leonardo does make this drawing that you talk about, which is based largely on guesswork, and he gets various things wrong. He has imaginary vessels between womb and the woman's breasts, say, that don't exist. He has an imaginary vessel in the man from brain to testes, supposedly carrying semen. It doesn't work that way.
I have to say, the way he depicts the penis and the way the penis works is really interesting. It's kind of a hodgepodge of, as you say, old theories and guesswork. But, and we'll warn people, and this is somewhat graphic, but he did actually stumble onto the actual reason a penis grows erect, and the story is a little creepy but kind of interesting.
Yeah, this was an observation, of course, since time immemorial that this happens. But why it happens, nobody quite knew. Yep. The standard explanation that Leonardo dismisses with disdain, he can hardly believe that people have proposed such a thing, is that an erect penis is akin to these long, skinny balloons that sidewalk people tie into knots and make animals with, that kind of thing. It's a light, air-filled balloon.
Yeah.
Leonardo scarcely bothers to refute it. He says, "Have you ever seen a balloon? This isn't like a balloon." But so it's not air that's providing the stiffening substance, he says. But what could it be?
Yeah.
And one of the things that Leonardo has done in his obsession with life and death and everything in between, he's attended various hangings, and in his day, that's not such a difficult thing to do as it would be today. There's lots of criminals dying on gallows, and he notices that the hanged criminals, men who have been hanged with a noose around the neck, die with erections. He, in fact, has a drawing that shows this. And why could that be? And Leonardo, not one to take things on faith, carries out dissections on several of these criminals and finds that the mystery, where does this, what is it that makes for the stiffness in the penis of these killed men? It's blood, he finds, in the course of a dissection. It's not air. And he's the first to discover this. It's about 14, or around 1500. And so this age-old mystery is solved once and for all. The answer is blood. Leonardo is very pleased with himself at having figured it out.
And the point of that, of course, it's more than just sort of an interesting novelty. It's this idea of the way blood works, the way it works in the body, was not understood very well. This idea of a pump wouldn't come for many more years, and so we really didn't know that in those days. How blood worked and how it coursed through the human body.
No, that came much later, and it was a great revelation when it did come. And one of the things it showed was that the heart was a pump.
Yeah.
We take that for granted now, and it's something that kids learn early on. But the notion that the heart, which was in those days a sacred heart, it was supposedly the essence, the core of a person's soul, the most important organ in the body, that it could be explained as a mere machine was more important than the way that machine worked. The notion that the body could be reduced to this contracting and expanding pump, that was a giant revelation, as if somebody today explained to us that the soul is a little ticking toy. We would be as bewildered and as reluctant to buy that discovery as in the 1600s they were to buy the announcement that the heart was merely a machine, was merely a pump.
Before we leave Da Vinci, I did want you to say something about what you write about how when Da Vinci is dissecting corpses was also a time when he was painting these very beautiful images, of course. Say something about that, because you say at the time he was painting the Mona Lisa, for example, he had been cutting open the faces of corpses.
It is one of the startling juxtapositions. The anatomical drawings that he's made, the drawings themselves are quite beautiful, but when Leonardo talks about them, he says it's horrifying to behold. If you saw him in his working conditions, he's in the dark, he's in the cold, so that the bodies won't decompose in warmth. So he's cutting and he's slicing and he's fighting down his squeamishness, and then at the same working day. Although now he's in a brightly lit room instead of in a dark cell somewhere. He's doing sketches. He's painting the Mona Lisa. He's working on the Mona Lisa and these anatomical dissections at just the same time. But it's not only that; it's at the same time he is at night studying and dissecting the muscles of the mouth to see exactly how it is that smiles work. What is it that happens when a person thinks of something pleasant and she smiles? Physically, what goes on? And then he's proceeding from that investigation with knife and scalpel to taking up paintbrush and drawing the Mona Lisa and making that smile that 500 years later still baffles and intrigues people.
Let's talk about the different ideas that start to emerge. And it seems like there's a kind of, I guess, a conflict. In fact, you describe it as a war between, the on one hand, the ovists, the people who believe the egg may be some kind of key here, and the spermists, those who believe it's seminal fluid that is the key here. It was a long-running war, you say. And talk a little bit about the different ideas of egg versus sperm, maybe.
One of the things that goes wrong, one of the things that makes these scientists, sets them into such a swamp of difficulty, is that rather than saying somehow man and woman combined to create this new form of life, what was that each camp said, what my side does is really truly important, mm-hmm. and what the other side does is try to horn in on the glory and claim a part in what's really my side's story. So one group of scientists believe that all the action is in the semen, that it has some kind of magical properties to shape a growing organism, and that the egg either is just there to provide nourishment for this male creation or maybe to provide a safe home, but does nothing creative to start this new life. And the ovis, on the other hand, the egg camp, say that what goes on is that there's an egg, and that's truly important, and that's where life develops, and you see eggs all around you every place you look at any kind of birth in the natural world, and it's the same story in the human world. And yes, semen is involved, but its role is merely to as some kind of a key in an ignition switch that starts a process, and that's its only role.
Yeah. Let's talk about one who's on the sperm side, really fascinating Dutch scientist, Antony van Leeuwenhoek, is it?
Yes. So he was one of my favorite characters in this whole saga.
Yeah.
Leeuwenhoek is a Dutch scientist in the late 1600s, and he's the first to look through a microscope and see that there are hidden worlds, there are living worlds within it. Nobody had suspected that there was such a thing. We had talked earlier about the religious views that nearly everyone at this time held, and one consequence of that view was that it didn't make sense to imagine that there could be these micro worlds, these worlds too tiny for humans to see.
Yeah.
Because why would God have bothered to do that? The point of the world was for humans, to provide a place for humanity. Why outfit it with billions upon billions of creatures that no one could see? So no one had any idea that there could be such a thing. Now Leeuwenhoek comes along. He's used magnifying glasses in his work. He's a cloth merchant to look at cloth samples. Now he makes better magnifying glasses, essentially, and gets it in his head to look at pond water, at blood, at rainwater, at anything he can think of. And everywhere he looks, he sees countless hordes of twirling, spinning, swimming little creatures. And he's obsessed, and he stays obsessed throughout his long life with looking at these new worlds.
He thinks he can see male and female sperm cells. Talk a little bit about that, which leads to a lot of strange theories. There was one put forward by, I think it's a Dutch mathematician, Nicholas Hartsocker, I think is his name. You mention him in the book. He has this idea that there were tiny little men inside sperm cells.
Yeah, he's Leeuwenhoek, the microscope scientist, sees at one point. In fact, he goes to bed with his wife one night, and he writes very proudly. He races up out of the bed holding a goopy sample in his hand. He runs over to his microscope. He looks at it through the microscope, and he sees what no one has ever seen before: millions upon millions of these tiny little swimming eel-like creatures.
Yeah.
And now there becomes a great mystery to find out. Boy, they certainly look like they're alive. What have they got? What's their role in this story? What have they got to do with anything? And one of the notions of Leeuwenhoek and of this fellow, you say, another Dutch scientist named Hartsocker, one of the things they think is, well, maybe within these sperm cells, maybe where these new babies come from is within each of these cells is a tiny micro miniature person all curled up, kind of clutching his knees like someone in a race car. And maybe what the sperm does is carry this tiny miniature human from the male into the female, into the uterus, where it will grow up.
I have to say, you were saying earlier that people were confused and perplexed by why would God make this system like this, where you had all of this, all of these writhing little worm-like creatures in such important fluid. I mean, that didn't help the spermist's case, I'm guessing. And you write about this idea of the time that wasting seminal fluid was an absolute abomination seen by some religious people as kind of mass slaughter. And then there's this panic in the 1700s about these habitual masturbators. We don't have to spend a lot of time with this, but say something about this time.
What goes on now is when Leeuwenhoek looks through his microscope and sees that there are millions upon millions of these sperm cells, this bewilders everybody, because everybody, including Leeuwenhoek, takes for granted that the world has been designed by God, who is a perfect creator. So why, when one of these sperm cells would do the job, has he made millions upon millions? It would be as if one book would be enough to inform somebody about some terribly important mystery, and someone had given you the biggest library in the world and said, find it. Why would anyone perfect do things in that way? So that was one big strike against this theory that the sperm cells were important. And then on top of that, as you say, by bad fortune for the spermists, along came a medical hysteria that masturbation was a terrible sin. It was physically, morally, it was the worst thing a person could do because semen was so precious, and here you were wasting it. And so now, for people like Leeuwenhoek, who was trying to say, well, yes, there are millions upon millions of sperm cells, but only one is necessary and the rest are wasted, that ran headlong into this theory that waste is a moral and a physical sin. How could it be that God had designed a system that was built upon waste? And so the spermists found themselves in a terrible predicament. They just couldn't make sense of what they were seeing.
We should mention William Harvey. He's on the egg side. This English physician, he's the one to discover that the heart, in fact, was a pump. Talk about his role in the story.
So Harvey is one of the big names in science. It is Harvey, as you say, who figures out that the heart is a pump, who figures out that that the blood circulates, goes around the body in a circle, out from the heart and back to it again. And Harvey gets it in his head that he has solved the greatest, what had been the greatest mystery, how it is that the heart and our life's blood works. And now he will take up the next great mystery. He will be the one, he believes, to solve this mystery of where babies come from, where life comes from. And he's perfectly prepared. In fact, he expects that just as he explained that the Sacred Heart was merely a bit of slimy muscle, so he's going to find some physical explanation of how it is that babies come from, where they come from. It's going to be some kind of pulleys and levers and cogs and gear explanation. And so he does various experiments on animals, because you can't experiment on humans. He watches deer mate, and just after they've made it, he cuts them open to see what he can find, fully expecting there will be some physical thing that he can see, just as he found the physical explanation of the circulation of the blood. But he cuts open these deer, and various observers crowd behind him and say, "What did you see? What did you find? What's in there?" And then steam from these bodies rises into the cold air, and Harvey, in anger and chagrin, says, I found nothing. I see nothing." And that was as far as he could take it. This was the great mystery. Where does life come from? He was sure that he was the one perfectly placed by training and temperament to solve it, and he couldn't.
Edward Dolnick, his book is called The Seeds of Life. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the science writer Edward Dolnick. I'll read the title of his book because it has a really long subtitle: The Seeds of Life, From Aristotle to Da Vinci, From Shark's Teeth to Frog's Pants, The Long and Strange Quest to Discover Where Babies Come From. By the 1830s, you mentioned in the book that many of the world's great thinkers had all but given up on figuring all of this out. There was one English physician, Peter Roget, said, "This mystery surpasses comprehension. We are not going to be able to figure this out." What was the breakthrough?
The breakthrough, so this is late. This is Roget's early 1800s, yeah. And people are saying, "Boy, too hard for us. We can't do this." What happens is that scientists who are looking at living creatures generally discovered that they're made of cells. People hadn't known this. Plants have cells, which the cell walls in a plant are easy to see. Animals have cells as well. And it turns out now that biology, which has been foundering without a theory, a guiding theory for a long while, now has some principle to organize all the various observations. And the notion is that just as sand and rocks and water are made of building blocks called atoms, so living creatures are made of building blocks. And those building blocks are called cells. And now, all of a sudden, the egg and the sperm, which have been these bewildering things for centuries, what are they? Are they animals? What could they be? Now the notion is that they're a particular kind of cell. And if they're cells, maybe it will do some good to try to look and see how it is that those cells work. And that's the breakthrough that finally gets these biologists looking for where babies come from out of this quagmire and started asking questions that turn out to be useful.
Tell us who Oscar Hertwig was.
Well, he's a name that that we don't know. And in fact, he was a name that I hadn't known. He's the first to actually see this union of sperm and egg. People have now wondered, maybe that's what's going on. Maybe there is these sperm cells. Maybe they're not just little worms that we can look down on and despise. And maybe the egg isn't just a source of food. So he's looking at sea urchins. It so happens that in sea urchins, fertilization takes place outside the body, so you can see it. And so they had been a subject of study for a long while. And in fact, in the lab where this fellow Hertwig worked, they were a particularly good thing to study, because at the end of the day, you could eat any leftover experimental subjects, because sea urchin eggs are good. But he's watching beneath his microscope a single sea urchin egg, and they're big, these eggs, and they're transparent. You can see into them. He takes an egg, and he takes a sea urchin sperm cell, and he jostles them so they're near one another. And now he watches, and as he watches, he sees what no one has ever seen before, that the nucleus of the sperm cell meets the nucleus of the egg cell, and those two round little nuclei join, and they make some new thing. And here it is. He's the first to see the conception, the origin of life before his eyes. And in a long and unromantic life, this is the one romantic moment in his life.
Why don't we know who he is? Why is his name such a mystery? I mean, he's the first one who actually sees the process of fertilization, and it seems like he's unknown almost.
Well, maybe we've done our bit to bring him into the light a bit.
How much earlier do you think all of this insight would have come if there had been better technology? You speculate about this a bit in the book. If there had been a better microscope, for example, could we have come to these ideas earlier?
That would have helped a lot. But the microscope, which people thought at first was going to solve this mystery in an instant because it did reveal these new and unsuspected worlds, turned out to be much more confusing than people had expected. When the telescope came along, the telescope immediately had people enthralled. It was space went on nearly forever. Everywhere you looked, there were amazing things to see, and people clamored for their own peek at a telescope. And when the microscope came along, people had the same high hopes for the microscope. But it turned out that the microscope proved bewildering more than entrancing, because when you looked at anything under a microscope, you did see all kinds of activity. But when you looked closer, first of all, the first view kind of vanished into the murk. And then if you looked even beyond that, you would see, again, more clarity, more activity. But each time you looked closer, you found what you had been looking at would disappear, and then it would give way to yet more complexity. Mm-hmm. So instead of finding the answer, it looked as if you would go on forever and ever and ever, finding ever more baffling, more complicated micro worlds. So better microscopes would have helped, yes, but sorting out what you were seeing was almost as difficult as finding those sites in the first place.
Yeah. Well, and as you point out, it would take us decades and decades to really unravel the mysteries of cell growth and cell division. And you say that, as you put it in the book, it wasn't just the machinery in a cell that was being passed along, but the real insight is that these were instructions that were being passed along.
That was a giant deal. In this era, there was a huge conceptual problem for these scientists, as brilliant as they were. And that was that somehow a human baby grew from a tiny starting point to a big product by birth. A baby is 5 or 6 or 8 pounds. It's got perfect fingers and toes and eyes. How does it know to do that? And the only example, the only way of thinking of it that these scientists could come up with was that there was a scale model, because they knew from architecture that you could have blueprints or you could have actual 3D models of a house or a cathedral. And so their notion was, here's something far more complicated than a house or a cathedral. So it must be that somewhere within egg or sperm, there must be a tiny scale model of the human being. That's what led the friend we talked about before, Heartseeker, into this notion of a tiny little passenger within a sperm cell. They thought that if you ended up with a big human being, you had to have started out with a little human being. How else would the body know how to grow? And the answer, we now believe, is what you say, that what was passed along wasn't a scale model showing the human being in miniature. What was passed along was instructions for how you make a human being.
Let me ask you finally, at the end of the book, you kind of lament a bit that our familiarity now with this process may have drained a bit of the surprise, maybe even some of the delight from it. Do you want to say something about that, finally?
Well, yes. There is often when we know something, we say, it does lose its charm, it loses its mystery, and we say, oh, of course. But actually, to look at the world, and in particular, this notion of new life appearing with fresh eyes, I think is worth doing. And the last passage in the book comes from a writer I like, who said that when we watch a magician, he pulls a rabbit out of a hat, and we say, isn't that magical? And what this writer says is, well, yes, it is, but what's more magical is pulling a rabbit out of a rabbit.
Edward Dolnick, his book is The Seeds of Life, From Aristotle to Da Vinci, From Shark's Teeth to Frog's Pants, The Long and Strange Quest to Discover Where Babies Come From. Joined us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Edward Dolnick, thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show was directed by Adrian Moranville, produced today by our intern, Zoe Wolf-McGinn. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.